Coming up on Life is a Festival.
We wanted to have a place where people could feel just respected and able to be exactly who they wanted to be, maybe who they're afraid to be in their day-to-day elsewhere. But this was a safe space. And to create that, there has to be no judgment. Over the years, we've learned that we need to foster that. It doesn't just continue to exist. We've also tried to have, you know, an element of humor right from the beginning in everything that we do. And so I think that kind of brings the fun and the inspiration to be silly and to let loose a little bit. We didn't want it to be exclusive. We want it to be inclusive and fun and feel free to be your weirdest self. And then that's what makes you sexy. It makes you beautiful. And it's not about gender. It's not about the typical, you know, definition of what sexiness is. It's like people feeling themselves is sexy.
My name is Eamon Armstrong, and this is Life is a Festival. This podcast is a celebration of thinkers and leaders who live their lives with the open-hearted, experimental joy of a festival. Each week, we converse in complete openness, in an ongoing quest to find those boundaries in our being and melt them into lofty horizons. Life is a festival, only to the wise. Welcome to Life is a Festival. This week on the podcast, I have a delightful conversation with Andrea Graham. Andrea is a DJ known as The Librarian. You might have heard of her. Also, co-founder of a festival in British Columbia outside of Vancouver called Base Coast. Now, I went to Base Coast in 2016 because I heard about this festival that was run by women in the forests of Western Canada with crunchy, gnarly bass music and just an incredible vibe. And I was not disappointed. And this conversation is not disappointing either. She is literally one of the most charming, delightful people I've ever had a conversation with. And you'll see. So we talk a lot about her career as the librarian, what it's like to be a DJ, advice as a DJ. We also talk a lot about Base Coast, and we really get into this idea of Base Coast being a festival that has a woman's touch. I don't actually know another festival that's run by women. And there's a really interesting thing that happens when you have this intersection of safety, sexiness, and humor. And that's really what Base Coast is all about. In fact, Base Coast is also called lots of things. Space Coast, Best Coast. Most of all, it's known as Babe Coast. And that's just such a beautiful idea because it's not babe as in like hot chick, sexy magazine. It's like babe, like the embodied babe, just so babelicious. And anyone can be a babe. And we talk all about being a babe on the podcast. And head babe herself, Andrea is just such a light, such a leader. And it was a joy to reconnect with her and have this conversation, which I am delighted to offer you. So without further ado, it's the librarian. Oh, wait, no, there is a further ado. She gave me a track called Blue Tusk, one of her original tracks. So we're going to end the podcast with Blue Tusk by The Librarian. So without further ado, let's jump in.
Ready when you are.
So recording and clapping. 1, 2, 3, clap. I think we're off from each other, but I feel like I can ultimately make it work.
Okay.
So I really like doing them in person usually. So it's kind of, I've done a few of them remotely and I keep trying to upgrade my remote podcast game. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we still live in 2019 where I can't just beam myself to you.
That would be very nice. I've often wanted a teleporter myself.
Well, you especially, considering how much travel you do. How many different places do you think you go to perform each year?
You know, I haven't counted, but I feel that on average, I'm gone 3 out of 4 weekends, like every month. And then in each weekend, there's probably two different places at least. So quite a few.
And on top of that, you produce your own music. On top of that, you produce a festival. On top of that, you mentor people in the music industry. On top of that, you're a mountain biker. On top of like, so you know what? Actually, let's not get ahead of ourselves because we'll get the how.
Okay.
Why don't we start at the beginning?
Okay.
And that is how I like to start any podcast is to ask you what a big win would be for you. What kind of podcast do you think would be most meaningful for my audience and also people who have come to your festival, people who enjoy your music, and your friends?
I think a podcast would be a win for all of our audiences if it gets to the heart of why we do what we do and kind of explains the motivation and reasoning behind that.
And I feel like that will be threaded throughout because we just started by talking about how you just do so much. And there's no way someone can do as much as you do if they're not driven by passion.
That is very true.
You were talking about, you know, traveling in a weekend and you're playing in different places and you're flying in the weekend. I had Atish on the show and he was talking about the DJ, kind of the DJ heroics of like, you're doing the sunrise set and then you gotten on a plane and then you're going to a different time zone. Do you feel like you have to do much of that as the librarian?
Definitely. I find the managing the time travel and sleep and just your basic needs is kind of one of the biggest challenges during all of the touring. And without those things in place, then it's hard to have the energy to be really present. But sometimes you just have to go for it and be exhausted, but go and play and be in the moment with everyone. So it's trying to balance doing your job and your passion at different energy levels.
Yeah. So what kind of advice do you give other DJs who have schedules similar to yours? Do y'all talk about this and kind of give each other advice about your techniques for managing it?
We do talk about it actually quite often because everybody has a completely different approach to it. Like some people are great nappers. They can sleep on planes and just squeeze in sleep whenever they can. I'm not a great napper, so that's not my tool, but I try more to be aware ahead of time of scheduling flights that are manageable when possible, and more so when I'm home on Mondays, even if it's exhausting, I set my alarm. I try and get on a normal schedule. I try and do exercise and like shock my body back into its normal circadian rhythm.
How long have you been traveling like this? Like how many years have you had this kind of a schedule?
I would say I started touring as a librarian about 10 years ago, but it's been the past 5 that have been increasingly a full-time job. But the funny part is I have another full-time job. So the last two years especially have been very busy, but now I have a management team that help take on some workload. And also within my other job, I have an incredible team. So it's starting to feel supported on both ends. But overall, it's been the past 5 years of full time.
And how long do you intend to continue? Do you think it's going to keep ramping up? Do you have kind of a plan? Do you want to DJ for a while and then transition? Have you thought about where you want to go with this?
I have thought about it a lot. I'm really happy when I'm actually in the moment playing music, connected to the people there, wherever it is. And that feeling feeds all of this for me. So sometimes I'm exhausted when I come back from a tour and I think, I don't know, you know, how much longer I want to continue doing that. And then I go play another show and it just resets all of that and I'm excited. So I don't have an end date and I don't think I need to have an end date really at this point. I just am striving to find more balance and that includes creating time off to make more music, because that's one thing that fell to the side as Bass Coast was growing and DJing was growing. My music production was the first thing to kind of slip. And so now I'm scheduling in time for that and creating space in my touring schedule for that and trying to stick to deadlines. And then, you know, the balance of everything else in life.
Wow. You are balancing for you sounds a bit like juggling. You know, like something is up in the air and something is caught, and then something is up in the air and something is caught. I guess that's sort of what you have to do if you want to have two really robust full-time performance roles.
It is. I could let go of one thing, but I don't want to. So,
why the librarian? Why are you called this?
Well, it was a nickname that stuck with me. And Liz Thompson, who is my business partner, co-founder of Bass Coast, she named me a long time ago, probably because I've always enjoyed a really wide variety of music. And I used to make these CDs that were just really eclectic and didn't really make any sense. But it was because I would just gather everything that I had found and throw it on a CD. And then once I was done with it, I'd pass it on and she would end up with all my hand-me-down, very random, weird CDs.
I love the librarian for you. I think it's just, it's one of those names where it just, it sort of goes so well for you. Like, it just seems like such a nice fit.
It is, because it fits with my wide interest in music. And also, you know, what I end up actually DJing is quite a contrast to being in a library. So that's, you know, one of the more obvious sides of it. And the fact that I just can't help but kind of look like one.
Well, and you know what's cool about it? So I've seen you perform at Bass Coast, which mm-hmm. is like you with the whole family there. And it's so rowdy. It's so, so rowdy. And you have this kind of expression, like this kind of cheeky, kind of coy kind of look when you're about to drop something really gnarly. And it was so, I was at Bass Coast in 2016 and just watching people go crazy. And then that pause, and you just kind of give like a little cheeky look, and then something just huge lands on everyone. And to me, I don't know why I think of a librarian, but there's this sort of kind of dynamic that's so cool.
I don't even realize that I do that look, but I have been told that that is something that happens, and it's pretty funny, so.
It's joyful. It's a joyful look. It's definitely yeah. like, here it comes, and then, yeah, it's It's wonderful. And so you DJed, did you DJ as the librarian before starting Bass Coast? What's the timeline for that? Like, how'd that kind of come together?
I would say a year, if even, before Bass Coast started, the librarian started. And it kind of all led to the creation of Bass Coast, because Liz, as a visual artist, she and I, as I was learning to DJ, decided we should gather all our creative friends and start throwing some wild parties in the Sea to Sky area here. And everyone would come and just do whatever it was that their art form was, whether it was cooking or, you know, teaching yoga or building mud wrestling pits or crazy stage design. Everybody just got really involved, and they were just, you know, renegade parties at first, in the woods by donation. They were just fun and a reason to gather all our friends, but they also helped us, I think, personally identify our own art forms, because we had this opportunity to express ourselves and to be supported by each other.
I really like that you got to personally develop your art form. So Bass Coast has been a community from the beginning and evolved as a community. So when you talk about a team working on this, it's not like a team like you hired someone who's a specialist at this particular thing per se. It's that you all organically as artists kind of blossom together. Would you say that's accurate?
Oh yes, 100%. We all were learning everything together as well. And I mean, through Bass Coast, once it began, I feel like we have met so many people that are professional and that have come in, and we've been learning from them. And, you know, now it's, the family has grown, but it really started from just a core team of friends.
And it's such a Canada thing for me, such a like a West Coast Canada thing. So there's so that sort of the history of BC festival culture. There's, I know there's Shambhala is kind of like in Nelson. Is that the first of the kind of bass music festivals in Western Canada?
That I'm really aware of, yes. Or maybe that's just because of the timeline where I sort of started to discover it. I missed the era of Soundwave, but I think that coincided with the beginning of Shambhala. It was out on Vancouver Island. But Shambhala was the first outdoor electronic music festival that I ever attended, and I think it was in its second year. And any other events like that that I had heard of were a little less maybe established, or just didn't grow to be as established in that sort of underground community sense. There were other bigger festivals like Summer Love, which I didn't ever attend, but I've heard legendary stories about, and that was probably around the same time Shambhala was starting, or maybe a little before.
I've noticed there's kind of a pattern of, there's a couple of different places where there's this kind of marquee festival like Shambhala or like Rainbow Serpent in Australia or like Secret Garden Party in England that are kind of a little underground, a little renegade. And there's kind of like one big one. And then it seems to, in each case, kind of have a child festival that's kind of an elaboration of it that's smaller and tighter. And it's sort of like the advanced partiers from that crew were like, well, what if we tweak and do a little thing? And then there's this sort of child festival. And I've noticed it in, you know, in a couple of different spaces that's kind of a similar process of groups kind of branching out. Was the Base Coast crew, were they kind of coming out of Shambhala in a sense? Were they all partying at Shambhala together? Or how did it all kind of come together?
Liz and I definitely were. We went to Shambhala and to Burning Man a number of times before the seed of Base Coast was planted, even in our own minds. So it was influential in that way. And a number of our friends had been going as well. So there's definitely cross-pollination. We just felt like there was room on the coast for something a little bit different than Shambhala, but that leaves space for Shambhala to be its own entity and Base Coast to have its own sort of vibe, but also hopefully that support each other in building this larger ecosystem of community.
So when I was first attracted to going to Base Coast, I was hearing about this festival in Canada, in Western Canada, that had this particularly sexy vibe, and the kind of sexiness that was described to me was, it wasn't like a sexy kind of like exploitative kind of showing off markety kind of sexiness, but there was a sort of kind of like rich embodied energy there, and that's been paired with, well, it's run mostly by women. The two founders are women, and there's a lot of women on that team. And so when I was first interested in attending the festival, I was like, I wonder what, I had these two pieces of information. It's very sexy, it's run by women. And when I went, my experience was, it was sexy, but it wasn't sexy in the way that I live in the US, and it wasn't this sort of like loud, exploitative kind of sexy. It was this sort of rich sexiness that felt very safe. And to me, that's what I think of as Base Coast now, as this space where it's safe, but it's also loose. And I think the safe feeling creates this loose feeling. And I just wanted to share with you, because I don't think I've ever told you this before, that idea of safety and looseness, after going to Base Coast, I've thought about that in every event that I've gone to. And I've come to this perspective that women's sense of safety at parties actually is what creates a loose vibe. That when women feel safe at parties, that's when everything feels a lot looser. And I've just noticed since Base Coast. So I just wanted to presence that and mention it because I don't think I've ever told you that I got that insight there. But I wanted to talk a little bit about how Base Coast, how did Base Coast get its vibe?
That is a really big question. Well, I think if we narrow down the vibe to specifically safety and freedom of expression, I would say that's something that right from the very beginning, Liz and I wanted to create. Like, we wanted to have a place where people could feel just respected and able to be exactly who they wanted to be, maybe who they're afraid to be in their day-to-day elsewhere, but this is a safe space. And to create that, there has to be no judgment. And over the years, we've learned like that we need to foster that. It doesn't just continue to exist, but everybody that comes needs to understand how to contribute to that safety. We've also tried to have, you know, an element of humor right from the beginning in everything that we do. And so I think that kind of brings the fun and the inspiration to be silly and to let loose a little bit. We didn't want it to be exclusive. We want it to be inclusive and fun and feel free to be your weirdest self. And then that's what makes you sexy. It makes you beautiful. And it's not about gender. It's not about the typical, you know, definition of what sexiness is. It's like people feeling themselves is sexy.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I wanted to use the word sexy, because sexy is the right word for it. It's not that it's sensual or like goddesses. It's not that vibe. It's sexy. It's raw. It's funky. But that loose humor is, I think, totally part of it. And you nailed it with this idea of feeling yourself. That, I think, is really the sexiness of Base Coast, is just the feeling yourself.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, men, women, any type of gender, you know, it's and every age and every way. And our bigger goal is that people take that feeling home with them, and that hopefully in some way it lasts, you know, into their regular life.
Well, and that is, of course, the point of this podcast, which is Life is a Festival, which is how do we take these magical experiences we have at places like Base Coast or at Shambhala or at Burning Man, and how do we bring them into our life? So you were just saying that part of the goal of Base Coast is that people could touch on this liberated, silly, sexy, embodied vibe and bring it into their lives. How have you seen that? Have you seen people express that in certain ways? How have you seen that play out?
I have. I feel so lucky that people come and share their stories with me. Often when I'm out at clubs playing, or I get messages with people just saying, you know, personal experiences of how they, you know, discovered a confidence that they didn't have, or that they realize they are creative and had no idea, or just that they, you know, now that they felt that they could go out and, you know, tell the world who they really are. And so there's just a lot of personal small stories that sort of indicate that there is this spirit going out there and lasting beyond the festival days.
Do you have any favorite cheeky kind of silly stories? You're kind of grinning a little bit. I don't know if you got one in mind that you would want to share.
I don't know if I can share them really because they're other people's stories.
Very fair. That's very fair. What are some, if someone was going to go to Base Coast for the first time and you were going to give them some advice about how to approach Base Coast in such a way that they could bring it into their lives, like, what would you tell someone going for the first time if you wanted them to like maximize the way that it impacted their life?
Okay, well, I would probably first start with all the basics of how to look after yourself at the festival.
That's Maslow's. That's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You can't self-actualize into sexiness unless you drink enough water.
Yes, exactly. But then going into your actual arrival on site, I always just suggest that people try and just talk to strangers and be open-minded and be willing to, you know, listen or share or not necessarily go in with an agenda or expectations, but go with the flow, try something new, just look at your weekend as an experiment and feel comfortable in reaching out to the community that's there, because there is a longstanding community there. And I realize that if you haven't been coming and it's your first time in any situation where there's friend groups, you have to make that decision to want to try. And so it's both sides. It's the existing community is open-minded and willing to accept and encouraging people to come and have fun, which I love about it. And new people, you know, reaching out and saying hi. And my favorite stories are people that have come on their own with no friends and, you know, biked there from somewhere far away. And they tell me how they, you know, met their new best friends and that has changed their life. So
I've found Base Coast to be so participatory in the like quirky, kitschy, silly, costumey things. There's like little like toast necklaces. There's like it's so zany and silly and wacky. And as someone who's been to a lot of festivals and particularly looked for like weird, I feel like Canadians and people at Base Coast particularly have this certain desire for the irreverent and for the silliness. Why do you think that is?
I honestly don't know, but there is a weird, wacky, wonderful aesthetic to Base Coast that I actually see.
It's wild.
It is, and it travels, and I see it now spreading into other festivals as well. Part of it started when we started introducing themes to each year, and our goal with the themes is that they are something that everyone can participate in easily, and the easiest way to participate is through sort of fashion, and we try and direct it towards fashion over costume. You know, it's for example, the very first theme was Year of the Zebra, because zebras have black and white stripes, which was our colors. At the time, there were no other colors in our official Base Coast color scheme. And they have a pretty rad haircut. And it was just really not for any deeper vision than something fun that everybody could sort of participate in that color scheme. And since then, we've had a wide variety of themes, some that have a really deep-rooted core meaning and a vision that's more philosophical, but it still has this element of easy to participate visually in. And these themes break the ice for people. It's like you instantly have something to talk to your neighbor about, and people run with the theme, and it got weirder and wackier every year. So maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah, like the Base Coast logo has gotten wackier every year too, like the unicorn, and then it's turned into a squid and like all these different things.
Yes.
So costumes are encouraged, or rather fashion, outlandish fashion. There's one piece of, there's one aspect of an outfit that is not at all approved at Base Coast, and that is the Native war bonnet. You were the first festival at all, of any festival, to ban wearing headdresses at the festival, which was a pretty bold move at the time. And I know that you got some pushback because I followed on social media. There was a whole conversation about it. What made you decide that this was something that wasn't acceptable at Base Coast? And how do you feel about what's happened as a result of that for the festival?
Well, at the time, we were aware that it had become this fashion trend to wear war bonnets, and that it was controversial. There were articles popping up in various, you know, newspapers and magazines, but no festival had gained attention for actually placing a ban on it yet. And so when we booked A Tribe Called Red as our headliners, and they, you know, requested that nobody wore a headdress. We thought this is the perfect opportunity just to educate our attendees on why. Also, Base Coast takes place in Merritt in an area where there are five tribes that reside there. So five Indian bands. There's a rich heritage in the area. And our intention with the statement was more of an internal within our festival sort of guideline on please be respectful. This is why you should not wear a headdress. And when we posted it, it really surprised us to see how far that message traveled. We instantly were having newspapers from all over the world interviewing Paul Brooks, who was our communication manager at the time and who crafted the statement. And
Paul Brooks should get a quick shout out because that dude is super smart. And I really love the way he words things. And yeah, no wonder he was involved in crafting that.
Yes. And he fielded all of the interviews and questions surrounding it. And yes, all credit to Paul.
And what a thing, it really, I mean, I think that may have put you on the map for some people too, to be like, oh, what's going on with this festival? What, why are they making these choices?
It really did. And then it was so incredible to see large, large festivals, you know, across the pond follow suit instantly. And even still, I think about a month ago, there was a big festival in California that introduced the ban and referenced Base Coast. So even though it's 5 years later, it still has momentum.
I love that. I love the leadership in that. And it's fun to make a party and then be like, wait, this is actually political and this means something and our values are being expressed. And I think that that's frankly the best kind of partying is to party with your values.
It is. And the cultural appropriation conversation has now grown for us and continues to develop each year because it's not just war bonnets that are insensitive. And there are many more pieces of jewelry or clothing that sort of tread a thin line between being more acceptable in our just day-to-day fashion world, but they still actually hold, you know, cultural importance. And so this conversation continues for us every year.
I heard someone once described Base Coast as having a woman's touch. And from what I understand, this was a big sort of public pronouncement, and there was a kind of a conversation around that. And the idea that it has a woman's touch is an interesting jumping off point to talk about the fact that it's a festival run predominantly by women. There are awesome men on the team, but two women founders and kind of driven by women. And yet this, it has a woman's touch, you know, what does that even mean? That's kind of I'm curious what you think of that particular expression being assigned to your festival.
I've found it also a little confusing for me to understand what exactly a woman's touch is defined as. However,
yeah, right?
I've found it interesting what other people tell me it is. So,
oh yeah, what are some, yeah, what do some people say, what do some people say it is?
Well, a lot of people say it's the attention to detail in everything. And they give examples such as, you know, lights in all of the porta potties, and they're very clean, and that there's signage just when you need it, that you're cared for, you feel cared for on the site by these little details, of having harm reduction, people looking out just when you need it, security, like they say that from the moment you step onto site to the moment you leave, that there's safety in the site. And it's these elements that lead to the safety. And they describe that as it being from a woman's touch. Other examples were the layout of the site and how it's continually being fine-tuned and feels cozy and cared for, and that I think a lot of these comments come from people that come year after year and they see the evolution from time to time, and they associate that with our attention to detail.
So as you're describing this right now, part of me is like, that does kind of sound like a woman's touch. Like that does, you know, like that does kind of sound like some of the ways, the particular ways in which like my partner is thoughtful and that I might miss it. But it's not, I mean, let's not get into any kind of gender essentialism, because it's not that a man wouldn't be thoughtful in that way. And at the same time, it does kind of feel like these are kind of, it does feel feminine to me.
Well, this is why I struggle with it, because, you know, I also know male friends who have attention to detail. But I guess it's in what you have attention to detail.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay. I think when you talked about the safety aspect, because I think one of the things that happens with privilege is that you don't see it. So you don't think about taking care of someone who might not have that privilege. So for me, as a white male, my sense of safety, I can never feel what it feels like for a woman to feel unsafe in the way that women can feel unsafe. I can't feel it. So I can think about it, I can be told it, and I can try to be aware of it. But because I don't feel it, there are certain choices I just simply won't think to make. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, talking about gender in this way, the idea of the safety that's so, I mean, and the safety aspect of Base Coast with such a sophisticated harm reduction program is really cutting edge, really industry leading in many ways. And I think there is something to be said about a woman's sense of what safety means is going to be different than a man's.
I agree. And also beyond gender, cultural safety is something to be addressed. And that's something we've added training internally this past year. We trained all of our managers and supervisors on cultural safety, as well as bystander intervention training, so that when they're doing their orientations with their teams, they can also impart that knowledge to the volunteers and staff on each team. So hopefully each person that is involved in the festival is sort of on the lookout for that safety. And that way it extends further than just our harm reduction team.
And for the harm reduction team, there's a couple of key ways. I mean, harm reduction isn't just having an attentive kind of security at the festival. There is so much that goes into harm reduction. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the aspects of the harm reduction at the festival that you're most proud of?
Yes. Well, first, I would like to credit Stacey Forrester, who is our head of harm reduction. She also has a company called Good Night Out in Vancouver, and she has built our harm reduction team and strategy from the ground up over the past, I think, 7 years. And she has one of the largest teams of volunteers in our whole festival, because they have so many different aspects to what harm reduction does. So first off, everybody is trained on consent, trained on bystander intervention training, on how to help people in any type of sort of non-medical crisis. And we have a beautiful facility on site that is staffed around the clock, and sort of two different aspects of it, the more private area and the more open for everybody to come in, which we encourage everybody to do and learn. And learn about consent, learn about risks with drugs. Come and have some tea. You need a nap, lay down. There's a lot of supplies there and just a lot of knowledge to be shared. We also have what we call night guard chairs, and they look like lifeguard chairs. But they are stationed at each stage and also staffed around the clock with our harm reduction team, which wears these really cute, recognizable sort of coral shirts. And they're there to be available for anybody that needs help, and they're really easy to spot. And so if you need help, or you see someone that needs help, or you're just kind of feeling like something is weird, that's who you go to talk to.
That is so Base Coast to have like a lifeguard game, you know? And I think that's part of what I love about the confluence of factors that make Base Coast so cool, because the safety is part of it, but then the silly is still part of the safety. It's not that the safety is separate from the silly, you know? And I love that. It's such a... It makes it so rich, and of course, you know, you see the lifeguard, you're like, oh, that person's here to help. They're visible. It serves a function really well, but then it's also, you could maybe go interact with them, kind of play around. Mm-hmm. Super cool.
It's really fun.
I love that. Wow. Is that new? Was that around in 2016, the lifeguards?
No, I think
night guards?
We introduced it in 2018.
Okay. Yeah, I think I would have remembered that the year that I went. The year that I went, by the way, speaking of silly, I don't know if you remember this because we didn't see each other that much, but I was German the whole time.
I think I do remember.
I pretended to be a German the entire festival, and I figured I might be able to get away with it because I was in Canada, and I was actually going to Germany afterwards where I did not try to do it. But at the end of the festival, Paul Brooks came up to me and he was like, "Are you pretending to be a German dude?" And I was like, "No, come on. Why would I do that?" He's like, "They said there's a German guy in the media team. There's some German that's writing an article here." I was like, "I don't know what this is. I could not be a German. I can't even do the German accent now." But that was me. I was German the whole time.
That's hilarious.
Well, and it seemed like the right place to do that.
Well, and it would take a lot of commitment on your part to go into character for 72 hours.
Yeah, I think I can do it now. Yeah, because what I was trying to do was I was trying to teach the members of the Base Coast community about how to be responsible in their use of psychedelics. And so I had to be a professorial and to also teach them about this thing. But I'm not very German, you know, so if anyone knew a real Germans, they would not think I was very smart.
Well, we have quite a few Germans on our stage build team. I would have liked to see you interact with them.
Luckily, I somehow managed to dodge any actual Germans, but I kept with it for the full festival. I was fully German. So coming back a little bit to this idea of a woman's touch, and being a co-producer of a festival, are there any other festivals that you know that are founded and run by women?
I really don't think there are. In most of the festivals that I've gone and played, it's been male-driven. There might be a partnership with a female, but I haven't seen a full female team.
Yeah, there are definitely women involved in festivals, and, you know, like Dream Rockwell was part of, you know, Lightning in a Bottle, and, you know, Boom. There's like different, there are women involved, but there's, Base Coast does seem different in the way that it's really owned and run by women. How does it feel in terms of being like, do you feel like an industry leader in that way? Is it come up in terms of how you look at the festival industry generally?
Well, it's so interesting because we started doing this purely, from the point of view of us wanting to create. We saw a niche and we wanted to fill it, and we just were driven by passion. So we have only started to meet all of the industry people after we had started Base Coast. So it wasn't part of our thinking process to acknowledge that other people had a different style of team or did it differently. Like, this is just who we are and what we do. And I think since then I've realized that there's a big disparity out there, but it doesn't really affect us. We just do what we do.
When we were talking before this call, before this interview, when we had a call to talk about it, you told me that having a conversation about being a woman-run festival is a little bit different for you than having a conversation about being a woman DJ. And that when we were having that conversation, you mentioned to me that it's more interesting for you to talk about being a woman-led festival. That's a more interesting niche. But talking about being a woman DJ feels very tired to you and feels kind of limiting. Can you expand on that?
It does, because I feel like it's the most frequently brought up topic in interviews, and it brings the attention to the fact that there is this difference of representation in sort of the DJ realm of the electronic industry. And it's funny because I come from an athletic background where in competitive sports, there's, you know, what the females can do and what the males can do is entirely different. Like, there are limits to what women can do. But then when you look at playing music, we're all on the same playing field. There are no limits. There are limits beyond physical ones that may challenge, like cultural limits or economic. But when it comes to gender, a girl can DJ just as well as a guy. Same with music production. And so when I hear all of these interviews talking about what's it like to be a woman in a male-dominated industry, I feel like it could further that problem, because young women who are interested in getting involved hear this over and over again, and it could create sort of some hesitation in getting involved. And I think that over the past 10 years since I've started, there have been some small leaps in the number of women getting involved. And if we just now focus on what music are you into? What are you actually doing? What production gear do you use? What are the challenges? And ask the same questions that the guys are asked, then it might open the door for that ratio to change.
Have you ever called out an interviewer who has asked you this question? Have you ever had someone interview you and say, "So, what's it feel like to be a girl?" And you're like, "Hey, actually, let me school you on this." Have you ever done that?
I've wanted to. And, my question back would be like, what's it like to be a guy?
Yeah. Do you want to role play it real quick? I can be that interviewer and be like, "Listen, okay. I understand that you're a woman. That must be, you know, difficult in a world where there are a lot of men DJs. How do you cope?"
How do you cope with not having enough women around?
Wow. Yeah. 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 And, you know, how do you cope with not having enough women around? I think that then shines the light back to Base Coast. How does it feel when there are more women that are just involved in every level of the production? One of the things that comes up with a lot of critiques about festivals is gender parity on a lineup. And that's something that there's a kind of a conversation. Do you take part in that conversation at all in terms of what lineups should look like?
I do. Our curatorial team consists of Max Ulis, Lauren Burlington, and myself. And we are always aware of trying to create diversity within our lineup, but we haven't specifically set percentage targets. And the reason for this is because we want the lineup to be curated with the music first and foremost. And so we always start by building sort of a style guide for each stage that sort of determines the flow of styles throughout the day and night. And then from there, we start looking at different ideas for artists to fill those set times. And if there are the options within that sort of style guide, we will always choose the minority first if they're on par. And there are so many great women and non-white males now to choose from. So every year our ratio is getting better. There are many festivals now popping up that are going 50-50, and that is their goal with curating. There's also many that I don't think consider it at all, and it's very evident.
But sometimes it's painfully evident. Sometimes you're like, no one on your team saw that it's all white dudes.
Yes, or they'll book one female just to have a female on the lineup. And coming from the artist side of it, like, I don't want to be booked just because of my gender. So there's kind of both sides to this. Like, you want to have more females on the lineup, but you don't want to feel like it's a token.
Yeah, well, and I think that that's another way that Base Coast as a festival is in a leadership role, because the festival itself has a different perspective because it's run by women. And so the way that women are included can't be tokenizing, because it's just sort of, you're just thinking about it differently already. So I think that that's part of how we deal with the issue of tokenism, is actually having more of the leadership to be more equal creates ripples down the line. So it's not that this sort of tactic of creating diversity, it's rather the values. This is actually, I did a podcast with a fellow named Nexus who was talking about the distinction between tactics for achieving goals of diversity versus instilling values of diversity that don't then require tactics, which I think is a really interesting distinction.
It is really challenging to create more diversity across the board, not just within the lineup, but within every aspect of our festivals. Like, they are traditionally sort of one-sided in North America. And I think that that's slowly evolving and more cultural groups are interested and it's going to get better. But it isn't just in the lineup. It's in staffing, in volunteers, in attendees, in who photos are shown of in the crowd. It's everything.
Is there anything else around the subject of gender and electronic music that we should touch before we move on? I just want to have an open space for that. If there's any other kind of perspective, because we're on a podcast, so we can get nuanced about something. Is there anything that you like that you'd want to talk about on this subject?
I did listen to a really interesting interview on CBC. It was with Linda Perry. She's a producer who has written songs for everyone from like Pink to Christina Aguilera. She's in the pop world. But she, just this one statement she said really grabbed me, and that it's that if you're wearing a red shirt and you go out for the day, you notice all the other people wearing red shirts. And so what's happened with having male counterparts being sort of the leading edge of, let's just say, in the DJ world, is that you notice more of the males because that's what you're used to seeing. But there are all of these women out there that are starting to bubble up, and they just haven't had the light shone on them yet. And once this shift starts to happen, we're going to start seeing them more and more, and it will help feed that gender inequality.
I love that. That's beautiful. I also just love the way that Base Coast is about gender in another way, which is the Babe Coast thing. Base Coast is also called Babe Coast. And there's this idea of the babe. And Paul Brooks once, I interviewed him, and he once said something that I love, and I love it so much, I'm going to read it now, about the Babe Coast thing. And this is Paul Brooks. "People call Base Coast a lot of things. Space Coast, Space Toast, Bliss Coast, and of course, Babe Coast. Playing around with a name is awesome, but we're mindful of the connotations of certain nicknames. We don't want people to think that they have to be a babe to go to Base Coast, but what is a babe? In the context of Base Coast, a babe could be a person identifying as male, female, transgender, or other, who is given a space to express themselves and explore parts of themselves they might not be able to in their normal day-to-day life. To me, that's a sexy, attractive thing. And that's the babe in Babe Coast. We might attract an attractive crowd, but you don't have to consider yourself a babe to come to the festival. You can be any shape, size, or age. You can identify in any gender. Base Coast is for everyone. We invite everyone to come on site and get in touch with their inner babe. I personally think that nerds and intellectuals are babes. People wanting to expand their consciousness, those people to me, those are babes." I love this because for me personally, the limitations that I've felt as a man in terms of my own sexiness and playfulness and expressiveness really come down to this idea that a man needs to not be a woman. And this is something that when I was little, like boys don't cry, boy, you know, there's all this idea that you need to perform being a man, and being a man means not being a woman. What I love about this idea of Babe Coast is babe to me does have a kind of a feminine origin. And then to claim it and be like, I'm a babe, like I'm babelicious. I'm like babing out at Babe Coast. That to me felt as a man liberating. So to talk about the gender expression idea of Base Coast, that it's not just about, okay, women are liberated and feeling safe and involved. I, as a man, felt liberated to be a babe at Base Coast. And I love that.
I love that too. And sort of circling back to when you were asking about sort of stories or why I was smiling. And it was, I did receive a story from one person who basically just shared that they realized that they could express their non-male side out in the rest of the world after being at Base Coast. And it was so liberating, a life-changing for them. And now I see this person is on stage performing, being their true self throughout the year. And that happened. The seed of that happened at Base Coast. And that's so exciting to me.
I love that. For me, my exploration of gender came from Burning Man. When I first went to Burning Man, I saw men wearing fancy gowns and brunch lady hats. And I was so caught in this straight gay thing when I grew up, where it was like, well, I'm not gay, but so I need to be straight. And if I let my feminine out at all, then I'm gay and I have to go over onto the gay side. Like everything was felt so limiting. And then at Burning Man, they were just dudes, but they were fabulous in this feminine way. And the more I kind of pulled that thread, the more I found that I could express myself in these more and more vivid and alive ways. And it really was deeply healing for me. And I think that festivals have done that a lot for a lot of people.
I agree. And I think that's something that I always try and be careful when we are talking about it being female-led. It's not just the female side. It's just we're all trying to be in touch with all sides of ourselves out there. And Liz and I, we snowboard with the boys. We mountain bike with the boys. And so we have both sides to us as well. And so rather than it being this polarity, it's just about being in touch with the different sides we all have.
Well, and this is why I'm so glad that we're doing a podcast, because we get to follow this meandering conversation into the more nuance about this. So yes, this is a woman-run festival. Yes, there's this idea of a woman's touch. But as we go deeper, you know, it really comes down to this is a Base Coast. This place that you have created with these incredible colleagues of yours is a place for human blossoming. It's a place to be your more complete, integrated, alive, beautiful self.
I agree. And it's amazing that we're 12 years in, because when we first set out, I don't know that I could have defined this as sort of our clear goal, but it's really become more clear over time. And that's really beautiful. And I hope that I continue to learn as much from Base Coast, you know, and from the people that we're meeting through it, as we all are.
I'm going to embarrass you now, because I know that you are somewhat well known for your humility and for being, you know, a little coy and a little, you know, you tend to take the compliments and kind of give them to other people. I've noticed that about you. But I'm going to embarrass you, because I want to talk a little bit more about how you have come to this role of leadership and how you've become so important to so many people. And the reason we're going to talk about that is not just to lay on the praise, but I think that for the listener who's looked at what you've created in your life, you've created a really beautiful life, not just in your own expression, in your music, but you're a real leader and a real mentor to a lot of people. And I'd love to be able to open source that a little bit and share a little bit about your journey and how you've become this, you know, multifaceted being that's doing so many amazing things.
Okay, let's chat about it.
Okay, so when you were little, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a figure skater or a sound engineer.
Oh, okay. I wanted to be a singing chef. And when did you first recognize that you were a leader, that you were leading the way and opening doors for people? When did you first notice that in yourself?
I think very young, I think it started more by recognizing that I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and that is a leader. And I thought about it more, though, from wanting to create my own sort of life than specifically being a leader. The leadership was like a byproduct of it. And I think when I was 14, I started a boat washing business. I started a bunch of bands and played in bands. And that's, you know, also a type of leadership. And it just came pretty naturally. I worked at a marina and then quickly became the manager of the marina. Like, it was just a natural evolution for me.
Do you have formal mentorship relationships with people in your life where you would say, I am mentoring this person, they consider me someone who's mentoring them? Not necessarily the language, but something that you would follow a kind of a traditional mentorship space?
I don't. It's something that I've just recently been thinking more and more about wanting to do. I don't know that I have the time currently, but we do work with a business coach who is our mentor. I haven't taken on the role of a mentor myself, but I would like to, because I think it would be a really great experience for me as much as the other side, because I've learned a lot over the past 12 years of Bass Coast and DJing.
Well, I'll plug my own podcast right now and say that I interviewed my mentor, Chip Conley, who founded Fest 300, about mentorship on the podcast. So I'll shoot you over that podcast. The reason I bring it up is because, and the reason that I say formal mentorship, because you do mentor people. I mean, people look up to you and you have a reputation as taking the time to answer people's questions and being available for people. And that's all mentorship. The reason I brought up the question about formal mentorship is, and maybe another way to approach this question might be, what advice would you give to someone starting out as a DJ who would love to see themselves where you are now?
I would suggest that they get involved in many aspects of the industry, that building relationships and helping put on events and doing the work around all parts of shows will help you go further, because there are so many people out there who just want to DJ, but building your own momentum can help take you so much further. And I feel that that's when we look at booking the lineup, for example, it's people that have created momentum in their own cities each city's community look up to. And so we're collecting those artists at Bass Coast, but they've already collected their own community around it. So I always suggest people get involved and try not to burn any bridges and just work very hard and keep at it.
You know, it's funny you should mention this, because I remember the first time I ever saw you. I remember it very clearly. I went to Shambhala in 2014. And it was on Thursday at Shambhala. They call it Day Onesie, and everybody wears onesies. It's very cute. To me, very Canadian. I don't know if you as a Canadian would think that's Canadian. I think that's Canadian. It was the first night, and it's my first time at a festival outside of the United States. And I was all eager beaver, and I was sent there for work. I was a journalist, very excited. And the first night, there was a performance, and there was a DJ who was playing, and people lost their fucking minds. People were like, there was so much energy, and it was so wild, and there was so much love in the audience. And I was like, who is this person? And like, oh, that's the librarian. I was like, what? Why is, how does every, like, is she like really famous, or like, what's the deal? And it's like, oh, well, she runs Base Coast. Like, this is all Base Coast. And I just looked, and it was clearly, it was like the tribe had come to like support you. And I think that when you think about trying to create a career as an artist, building an audience really is building a community. You know, it's building your connection to people. And when you're saying, you know, try all these different things, be involved in these different touch points, it certainly makes you more useful and more involved, but it also kind of helps you be in community with people. And that's, I think, how real followings generate.
Oh, I completely agree. And it takes repetition and going through the highs and the lows of time. It takes time to build a community. And so I would also suggest that artists go out and, you know, start a weekly or a monthly night and learn from that. And it might lead to that 10,000 hours you need to be successful. And not only in your skills, but lead to that community.
One of the things that a lot of artists struggle with, especially younger artists, is the business side of things. You know, there's this, you know, the horribly pernicious narrative of the struggling artist, that it's only authentic if it's not monetizable. How would you coach someone about the business side of things and creating a sustainable life?
I always suggest that people try and keep an income outside of their art as long as they can, because it allows them to craft their art without the need to cater it towards being their income, which can shift the intention and the anxiety and the stress and everything around that. And hopefully, eventually, that art will take over the income. But if they're forced into right away taking every DJ gig because they need to pay their rent, then all of a sudden you might be making those choices to play things that aren't great for your career or for your soul or for your health. And so that would be the first thing I would say, is try and maintain your income before you get to the starving artist phase.
Yeah, I feel that. This podcast is never going to make me a millionaire. If I start to think, because it's been growing lately, and I'm super proud of it, and I have fans who've never met me, that feels great. By the way, if you're listening and you've never met me, you make me feel good. I feel very proud of that. But the minute I start thinking, okay, this is it, this is my career, I'm going to make money doing this, there starts to be a kind of squeeze, and then I got to hustle, and then instead of having this awesome conversation, I'm like, okay, I gotta get like Skrillex. What are Skrillex and I gonna talk about? Or like, I gotta jump industry. It can't be Life is a Festival. It's gotta be like, what's bigger? Life is Politics. And then I'll do that. You know, all of that kind of thinking, that kind of grasping, I think is a really hard part of wanting to make a space in the world as an artist. And I think having your art as a side thing, as you're building a kind of complex life with a bunch of different facets, you get fed in different ways.
And you don't burn out either. I think that's helpful, because there is that stigma that you need to be starving and, you know, sort of on the brink of happiness to create art. But I don't believe that's true.
I don't think that's also like the idea that if you have issues with mental health, that will make you a better artist. I think that's one of the worst, horrible stories, that, you know, like, I mean, it's beautiful to create art out of difficulties in your mental wellness, for sure. But let's not stay stuck in a difficult mental space, because we're going to lose our edge if we get out of, you know, the darkness. Mm-hmm. That's a tricky one. The mental health, do you have any, if you don't mind me asking, we're on a podcast. Mm-hmm. Does all of this DJ scheduling and all the stuff you do, does that affect your mental health? Do you need to do any management around anxiety or around anything with all of this travel and all this work that you're doing?
I feel very fortunate that I'm fairly even emotionally. I have, you know, this type of lifestyle can be really hard on relationships. So that can be a struggle. And I've had to really learn how to just go back to those basic needs of valuing sleep, valuing exercise, eating well, even when you're really tired, and just pay attention to those basic items. And also saying no. And that's a really, really hard one for me, because I get excited about all these opportunities and traveling and meeting different people. But when you're looking always 8 months ahead, it can be a little overwhelming when you're really tired in the moment and this next week feels really tough, but you're making decisions about what gigs to take 8 months or a year ahead of time. So in order to do that, I have to really take care of those, just sleep, exercise, eating well, trying not to drink too much. You know, moderation.
Self-care is just the name of the game in all of this. I think, you know, the podcast is Life is a Festival, and so much comes up as like, and drink water, you know?
Yeah, and drink water.
Life is a festival and, you know, eat more vegetables. It's like, you wouldn't think that, you know, the lavish lifestyle of festivals and partying would really boil down to eating more vegetables, but it kind of does. You need to fuel your body.
You do, and I think it's becoming more and more common to have people that are out there touring year after year. So many more people are sober touring, or, you know, close to that. And it's becoming more accepted and more talked about. So I think that the trend is positive in that self-care is a common topic. And I like that.
But the most listened to episode of my podcast was Atish talking all about this and all about self-care, and specifically talking about his own anxiety and how that showed up for him as a DJ. And he actually chose Life as a Festival as the place that he wanted to like really go deep on it, which I was very honored to hold that space. And just each one of those conversations that make it okay, each one of those conversations that make it like, you know, there are some really difficult mental health issues in the DJ world. There are people who are really suffering. And the more that you hear, you know, it's okay to be sober. Like, it's okay to say no to a gig. It's okay to say no to crazy travel. It's okay to call your manager up and be like, my health needs this. Mm-hmm. I need to keep myself safe. And that way we can avoid more, you know, tragedies in our community where people pushing themselves too hard.
I agree. And If that's something that the individual can't say themselves, like that's when it's worth it to bring somebody on to help you be that voice, and somebody else to be your manager and say no. And because ultimately everybody wants you to have longevity.
Speaking of longevity, what's next for Base Coast? Where this is the 12th year coming up?
This is the 12th year. We just launched our tickets this past week, which was really exciting. And
And we'll have that in the show notes. So if you love this and then want to go to this party, promo Base Coast right now. It's an amazing party. If you didn't get that from this conversation, it's an amazing party. It's an amazing community. I'm going to do a little promo for you so you don't have to do it. Base Coast tickets are on sale. Okay, go ahead.
We are going to also announce our theme very shortly, which is very exciting because
can you tease it? Can you tease the theme on the show?
So every time that we try and subtly tease the theme, somebody gets it. It's crazy how in tune people are with it. So this year we've decided that we'll tease a bunch of themes. Some of them may be the real theme. Some of them may not be the real theme. And we're just having fun with it. So I'm not going to say anything right now, but if you just follow the Facebook and the Instagram, you're going to see little hints of different directions of the theme. Which one will it be?
Okay, I like that. So the tickets are on sale and you're about to announce the theme?
Yes. And
when is that announcement?
I think it's December 1st because all of our applications also go live on December 1st. So that's art grant applications, because we have a large art grant program where we fund people's ideas and they build their art and bring them to site. And it's really nice to have the theme ready when you're coming up with art grant ideas. Also, all of the other applications will be open. Music applications are only open from December 1 to 15. So it's a very short window because there are a lot of people that apply. So to anyone out there interested, make sure you get your application in.
Nice.
And we're going to be doing our 12 days of Basemas, so a play on the 12 days of Christmas, where we give away music each day over the holidays, which is one of my favorite.
Yeah, you've been doing that for a while, right?
We have. And last year, we curated a release, a compilation of 12 amazing singles, and then we released it on Bandcamp, and all of the proceeds we donated to West Coast Environmental Law. So that's one of our sort of bigger directions, is to be supporting the fight against climate change however we can. So this year we'll be doing that again, and also we've been offering people the option to donate when they purchase a ticket. There's a little pop-up, so we gotta do something. Hopefully we can contribute to that and affect change.
So important. And I think that with festival culture, the conversation around environmentalism is super important. You know, Burning Man, like, got to get carbon neutral as much as possible and contribute. Absolutely. I'm glad y'all are doing that. It's important. Partying is political.
It is. And also, as much as there's, you know, there are ways the festival can reduce their waste and energy usage, it's also in everybody that's traveling to the festival. So we're doing initiatives on sort of giving ideas that help people to lower their individual impact coming. For example, with the theme, you don't need to buy all new things to participate in the theme. Try and find ways to reuse items and cut down on purchasing.
I got to give another shout out to my own podcast. Ash and Tesla, the Glitter Spies, who are LA-based festival fashionistas, we did a podcast together and we talked about this exact thing. Like, how can you be fabulous and fresh and new while being mindful about the environment and not falling prey to fast fashion? And they had a bunch of great techniques. They talked about thrifting and they just, you know, building outfits from colors in certain ways where you can like add little things that aren't really expensive or like something you wouldn't wear, but because of the outfit and because of the color palette, it turns into something. So yeah, I think it's something really important in the festival world, is we love our fancy outfits, we love being fabulous, but we don't need to buy, you know, tons of new coats made out of plastic.
Exactly. For the past 2 years, we partnered with Evan Bedell. He's a designer out of Toronto who actually won the first Project Runway and came second in the All-Stars.
Oh, okay.
And he's a friend that I actually met at Burning Man years ago. And he did this really cool initiative. I think it was partnered with Eco Fashion Week in Canada, and I'm not sure what the other organization, but the goal was he went to Value Village, picked out 85 pounds worth of in weight of clothing, and had to design a line that utilized every single pound that was current. And so then he did this runway show at Canada Eco Fashion Week, and it was so inspiring. And there is a documentary about it. It's worth looking up if you Google Evan Bedell.
Oh, we'll put that in the show notes. So you won't even have to look it up. You can just look on the show notes. And wow, that's so cool. I love festivals that are communities and that are driven by values. And I think that those things go hand in hand. I think that when a festival is driven by values, it forms a community. And when a festival forms a community, it's driven by values, because that's kind of how we coalesce. You know, we're, you know, I go to Burning Man, and Burning Man has its issues for sure, but a lot of the stated 10 principles are things that I apply in my life. That's part of how I make my life like Burning Man, is I take these values. And, you know, when you look at making your life like a festival, really what carries on past the festival, values and community. Those are the biggest things. What did I learn? I learned to express myself. I learned to be humorous in my sexiness. I learned to challenge my gender in a new way. And what did I get from it? All these friends and this new art project I'm going to do. And I just love that.
I love it too. I'm so amazed at just the collection of friends that I now have through Base Coast and festivals. And really, I have to thank, you know, going to Shambhala that very first time, that sort of sparked the seed for all of this to happen.
And I think shouting out to all the friends is a great way to end our conversation tonight. You know, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. And we go and we party and we connect and we create community and we create friendships and we do silly things together that make our friendships deeper. And then when the rubber hits the road, when things get harder, our friends come and show up for us. And I think that that's really, that's the beauty of this work and this world that we're in this. And we're part of a global community of people who are festival enthusiasts and dance music enthusiasts and creatives and entertainers. And it's such a blessing.
It really is. I'm excited to see where it goes from here.
Well, I hope that this podcast can help forward momentum and people listening can try out some of these things themselves and maybe start your own festival or, you know, go for it.
It's been so nice chatting with you.
It really has been. It's really, I love this because I just get to have like a nice chat with you. I haven't talked to you in like 2 years and it's so nice.
I know.
Thank you for joining us on Life is a Festival. If you enjoyed this episode, you can support it by sharing it with your friends and leaving a review on iTunes, letting us know what you thought. If you'd like to keep up with me, you can visit my website, eamonarmstrong.com. That's eamonarmstrong.com or Eamon Armstrong on your favorite social platforms. Thanks for tuning in. Together, we can make life a festival for everyone. See you on the dance floor. So the podcast is over.
Okay.
But the microphone is still running. Okay. And I get to ask you my last question, which is, how do you think the podcast went?
It was so great. I thought that it flowed really well. I love how you guided the conversation, and we touched on so many different topics, and it felt really natural and fun, and I really enjoyed it. So thank you.
I really enjoyed it too. And you're good at being interviewed. So I've been doing this enough where there are some people who are totally new, like it's their first podcast, and totally understandable. They tend to go kind of all over the place, but you're quite good at answering the question and kind of like hit your mark pretty clearly. And that allows a kind of nimbleness to say, oh, okay, that's a good point. Now here's another point. So, you know, you're a fun interview. It was punchy. Like, we got to move to a lot of different terrain. It didn't get bogged down in sort of heavy tangents that needed a lot of over-explaining. And that can totally happen with this kind of medium.
You must see so many different styles of conversation. It must be really interesting. But I appreciate you saying that, because podcasts were something that made me nervous. And then I did that one with TMSV and found that I really enjoyed it. And over the past 2 years, I've also been trying to just participate in any type of panel discussion or more speaking engagements, opportunities that come up, because I was afraid of them. And
you have a great voice. You have a meaningful voice and position, and you have an audience. You have people who admire you and look to you, and you're a role model for people. So the more that you can develop that voice, it's like you were saying earlier as a DJ, the more you developed all these tangential skills, the more the more impact you can have. And I think for you, like, you're clearly a dynamic, influential individual in your community. That's just going to grow. And I hope this podcast is part of that.
I feel like it is. So thank you.
Awesome. Well, gosh, it's been such a pleasure. I really enjoyed myself.